Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In June 2018, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won the Democratic primary for New York's 14th congressional district. It was a stunning defeat of 10-term incumbent Joe Crowley. In his new book, We've Got People, today's guest, political reporter Ryan Grimm, traces the history of progressive Democratic politicians from Jesse Jackson, who ran on a platform championed by the Poor People's Campaign, to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He illustrates how the movement that propelled her to Congress has been building for 30 years, and how conservative and centrist and corporate Democrats have resisted it. Next week, 20 Democratic presidential hopefuls will face off in their first debates. So how are progressives mobilizing on issues like health care for all, unions, taxes, militarism, and other issues? Talking with us today is Ryan Grimm. He's D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept and a contributor for The Young Turks. His latest book is We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you, and it's great timing for your book, given that everything that's happening. I want to ask you why you decided to write about this. I understand that you started covering D.C. politics in the 2006 midterms, and you felt that when Bernie Sanders took off in 2015, there needed to be something for people who were relatively new to politics to really learn about the history of the progressive movement.
Yeah, that's right, because I had watched a kind of nascent progressive movement that had kind of flowed out of the Howard Dean presidential campaign and attempted to influence Democrats in the 2006 midterms, and then tried to drive the Obama administration to the left, just not get much coverage from the mainstream media, which I was a member of, and then maybe continued to be a member of, whether or not you'd consider the Huffington Post at the time, mainstream media. And I thought about writing the book as far back as 2010 to kind of highlight that energy that was being overlooked. But, the closer I looked, the more I realized there wasn't really enough of a character or enough characters to kind of stand up the narrative. In other words, the left was almost too weak at that time to write a book that didn't end in just cynicism, that these folks are just going to get annihilated. And so then, like you said, when Bernie Sanders had his surge in 2015 and 2016, that brought a lot of new people into politics, and it kind of broadened people's imagination of what was possible. Then after Trump was elected, you had another kind of surge into politics with the Women's March and people being galvanized into activism by the shock of Trump becoming president. And from there, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez knocked off Joe Crowley in the primary, that's when I figured, okay, now there's enough energy on the left to kind of stand up a book that doesn't end in just pure cynicism. And I actually kind of decided to pull the trigger on it on my way back to D.C. from the Bronx the day after that she had won.
Well, yeah, and that's great, because there's so much cynicism out there. And as you say, I think it's important because there's so many new and young people that are now involved in politics. Mm-hmm. And in the age of social media, I've met a lot of these people, and the fact is they do in some ways have short attention spans, and they're not reading as much as past generations. I mean, they're very interested and excited, and I'm being very general here, mm-hmm. for sure, but can you just talk about the importance of young people especially learning this history?
Sure, and I don't want to shame them either, because I don't read as much as I used to. I'll sit at home in bed with a book, and my phone will be on the book, and I'll catch myself just checking Twitter instead of reading the book that's literally on my lap. But I wanted to write this for people, like them, who had just come in, because there have been so many people fighting in such interesting ways over the last 30 years that they'll find, an extraordinary number of echoes in the past, particularly with Jesse Jackson's campaign in 1988, the way it came so close to winning thanks to an upset in Michigan, just like 2016, but had the full weight of the party establishment brought down on it. And if you you lined up the platforms of each, you know, against each other and just kind of edited for the language of each generation, you'd find them pretty much identical.
Well, since you brought up Jesse Jackson's campaign, you write, and this is in 1988, this campaign, you write, in some ways, the Jackson campaign was an answer to the question of what an alternative strategy for the party, one rooted in people rather than money, might have looked like. It was one that excited Democratic voters, but had them wondering if Jackson was truly as, quote, electable as the safer Michael Dukakis.
Right. Right, and that's the other amazing thing is that the you know you can go back and back and back, and you'll continue to find this kind of self-punditry going on among Democratic voters, where they will say, "Well, I really like this person. This person represents my values, and I think would be the best person to lead the country, but I think other people might not agree with me, and so therefore I'll vote for the person that I think other people will like, though they don't have a ton of evidence that." These other people exist or will like this person. And so they wind up with people like Michael Dukakis or like John Kerry in 2004 or Walter Mondale. You know, this electability idea just kind of runs through Democratic primaries for generations.
And we'll talk about that also in the show today. But I wanted to also bring up one more thing about Jackson's campaign and to go back a bit further. As you note, his campaign was really an outgrowth of the 1968 Poor People's Campaign. As you write, he embraced single-payer health care, gay rights, called for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, free community college, reparations for descendants of slaves, gender pay equity, and an end to Reagan's drug war, with a focus instead on banks who facilitate money laundering. I mean, you know, when I read that, just think dreaming about where we would be today if we had really embraced those policies back then.
Right, and there was a reason that the Democratic Party or the establishment wing of the party wasn't embracing those strategies. And it wasn't that they necessarily thought they couldn't win a majority on it, but they had invested in a strategy by that point, beginning in the early 1980s, that they were going to kind of finance the party structure using corporate money and Wall Street money. And so that type of a platform just runs up against the idea of a kind of multiracial, progressive, populist platform. You can't have both. And the party, in response to Reagan, had decided that they were going to go the money route. And this was Jesse Jackson's and the left's attempt to say, well, there is an alternative. Stop saying that there isn't one. So let's see if we can pull it off.
And just remind us, when Reagan came to power, that's the time when you had Newt Gingrich and a number of very radical right-wingers come to power. And they sound like Mitch McConnell and a number of the radical right-wingers today, that everything Democrats stand for is wrong. They play by very different rules than the Democrats. And you say something really interesting about Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and other Democrats who were around at that time and who are still, you know, really leading the party today. They were completely traumatized by that. And they really internalized this idea that we live in a center-right country. I mean, you hear that from people like David Brooks. They don't say that specifically, but, you know, when you look at their actions, you can kind of come to that conclusion. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, and you know, as they grew up, they came up in the post-New Deal era, you know, where Democrats were dominant, where the progressive conversation, or the conversation was being held on, you know, on essentially kind of liberal / progressive turf, and Democrats were largely in power during this kind of 30-40 year reign, where you know they oversaw the largest growth, economic growth in world history, really. And so as they're coming into their own politically, this shock of first 1978, where you have Newt Gingrich and these other radicals elected to the House, and then Ronald Reagan in 1980, so these are not the kind of center-right Rockefeller Republican types who are, you know, friendly with Democrats but just have a slightly different idea of how they want to organize the economy. These are people who are rejecting everything the Democratic Party stands for. And not only that, and I think this is a thing that a lot of people have overlooked, the Democrats also lost 12 net Senate seats in 1980 and lost some absolute lions of the Senate, like Frank Church and Birch Bayh, for instance. So it would be as if not only was Trump elected in 2016, but Elizabeth Warren lost her Senate seat. You know, Bernie Sanders lost his Senate seat. Dick Durbin and Chuck Schumer lost their Senate seats. And it left a shell-shocked party that was wondering, you know, what on earth is going on? What do we stand for? Why has the country so thoroughly rejected us? And they still controlled the House of Representatives. So the strategy they came up with was, you know, let's go to corporate America and say, look, you know, we control the House of Representatives. You have to pay up, and we're going to use that money to match Republicans dollar for dollar on television ads, because that's why we lost so badly in 1980, is that we couldn't compete with them on the air.
And those senators that you just mentioned that lost their races, they were very progressive senators?
Lots of them were. Now, some, you know, across, they lost across the board, but, you know, Frank Church of the Church Committee exposed some of the, you know, greatest war crimes, and the Church Committee evolved into the Intelligence Committee. Senators who had been, you know, the pioneers on environmental policy, on women's rights, on civil rights, who had, you know, decades upon decades of service, were all wiped out.
And why did that happen? I mean, given the history and the research that you've done, when you look at what's happening today with gerrymandering and massive, massive voter suppression, and the media landscape is just so incredibly different than it was back then, what explains those losses?
So there are a couple different factors. You know, some of it was structural. Realignment going on, you know, very slowly across the country, that, you know, running from the civil rights era up today. But some of the specifics start with, you know, Jimmy Carter winning the 1976 primary. You know, he was one of the more right wing candidates in the race. A lot of the left wing candidates kind of divided the vote, so he was able to slip through with, you know, 30% in Iowa, 30% in New Hampshire, comes to the convention with 40% and gets the nomination. And while we think of him as kind of a progressive hero in his post-presidency, during his presidency, this was a guy who was pretty hostile to labor unions and pioneered deregulation. We think of Reagan as the initial deregulator, but Carter really deserves that mantle. And so unions reacted the way that you would expect if they're being treated with hostility. You know, he faced that primary from Ted Kennedy from the left in 1980, which weakened him, but to the point that the establishment Democrats were making, it was true that, you know, in the 70s there were some Supreme Court decisions that really opened the floodgates to corporate money in a way that the analog would be Citizens United in our generation, and Republicans very much capitalized on that, and they learned how to exploit television, which was the dominant mass media at the time. A lot of these senators had been in office for so long that they just took for granted that their kind of legendary status, their accomplishments over several generations, would be enough to get them reelected, as it had been, you know, 4 and 5 times previously. They had never really encountered dirty tricks before. You know, this is the kind of burgeoning era of the Roger Stone politics, and Roger Stone specifically being involved. Not necessarily coming at them ideologically or politically, but discrediting them on a personal level. You know, the famous politics of personal destruction, and so that's why a lot of the Democratic establishment types said, "What we need to do is be able to figure out how to defend against this, and we need to be able to pull it off on our own." Which I think is actually true, but what they say is that that's all we need to do. It's, you know, a parallel today would be, did Russia interfere, you know, with the 2016 election? And you could say, well, yes, they did, and that's something to be concerned about. But that doesn't mean that the party doesn't need to rethink what its political strategy is. Whereas there were some who would rather just say, well, no, this was the problem, and if we focus on this, then we don't have to fix the party.
Right. Can we also talk about money in politics? You've got some interesting information in your book about the DCCC, and we'll talk about that in a minute. We have done a lot of shows about what changed under the Clinton administration and how they really cozied up to Wall Street. But what really strikes you when you go back even further, when you look at what changed with the Democrats when they decided to take corporate money? and yeah, why so they did it.
Right, so it's right after 1980, and there's a congressman named Tony Coelho, who's now a lobbyist here in Washington, Southern California, and he's the one who pitches to the party. He says, "Look, the problem was we didn't raise enough money from corporate America. We can do it." He called the new innovation a PAC strategy, political action committee. Today we just call that fundraising. You know, that's how new it was that he had to have a name for it. So we're going to set up these political action committees. They're going to set up political action committees. They're going to funnel corporate money from theirs into ours, and we're going to turn the DCCC into a political weapon in a way that it hadn't been before. You know, previously it was a complete political backwater. It just wasn't used in the way that it is today. And so he made that case, and the Democratic Party was fine to say, you know what, Tony, it sounds reasonable. Go ahead. You want to run DCCC? Nobody else wants to run it. It's all yours. And so then in 82, by what you could call bad luck in hindsight for the Democrats, the Reagan recession and just the general tendency to kind of push back against a new administration resulted in this huge Democratic wave. And so, as they're celebrating their midterm victory in 1982, they're thinking to themselves, well, the money really worked. You know, we look back and we say, well, of course, you picked up a bunch of seats. The country was in a recession. That's how things go 2 years into a new presidency if there's a recession. But that wasn't, they thought that they had picked the lock there. And so the strategy was really, they bought into it big time there. When in 1984, they're annihilated again, and this time much worse, that becomes an even more traumatizing experience for them, because it's almost like and for some liberals, the second Bush election in 2004 was more traumatizing than the first. The first, you could forgive people. He's running as this compassionate conservative Texan, whose rhetoric wasn't terribly different from Al Gore's. By 2004, he's launched an illegal war based on manufactured intelligence. He's set up, torture sites around the world. He's building Guantanamo, and the public still reelects him, which causes all sorts of reflection of what on earth is wrong with us? What on earth are wrong with voters? How do we move forward from something like this? And so after 84, that's when the real trauma sets in that you're talking about, where people like Pelosi, Schumer, Hoyer say to themselves, we don't live in the FDR America that we thought we did when we grew up. We live in a conservative country. And if we want to hold on to any modicum of power, then we have to moderate ourselves as much as possible, and we have to repress the progressive wing of the party, because they'll embarrass us, in front of this kind of mythic white working class centrist voter, and we'll never come back to power if we're associated with the, amnesty, abortion, and acid wing of the party.
And as you point out, when Nancy Pelosi took over the House in 2007, she took impeachment off the table immediately for George W. Bush's war crimes.
Right. The parallels again, because there was a huge push. And I think, to people who have just gotten into politics now might be surprised to learn that, one of the main things Democrats wanted in the mid-2000s was George W. Bush's impeachment. And not for merely obstructing a probe by a special counsel, for war crimes, for torture, for setting up secret prisons and expanding the unaccountable power of the executive branch in a dangerous way. The left wanted that checked, warning that what has since unfolded would actually unfold. And so, but Pelosi, as soon as she came in, she very publicly made clear, quote, impeachment is off the table, unquote. And it was, it was part of the idea of, okay, yes, we won based on a lot of anti-war and anti-Bush sentiment, but don't worry, we're not the crazy liberals, the crazy hippies that you think we are.
Today we're speaking with Ryan Grimm. He is a political reporter for The Intercept. He formerly worked with The Huffington Post, and he's the author of the new book, We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. And if you have any questions or comments for Ryan, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions about the history of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the ongoing tension between the progressives and the corporate Democrats, we'd love to hear from you. Also, 20 Democratic candidates will be debating for the first time next week. It's not going to be all of them on stage at once. It's going to be a group of 10 on Wednesday and then 10 on Thursday, and that starts at 6 o'clock Pacific time. And then yesterday was really interesting because the Poor People's Campaign had a huge gathering, and 10 Democrats took questions from not TV hosts, but actually Joy Reid was there. But it was a very different kind of setup, a people who are actually struggling to make ends meet, disenfranchised people, poor people, and the Reverend Barber, William Barber, asked questions about poverty, and it was a fantastic event. And if you have the time, I hope you can listen to the audio. 866-798-8255 is the number to call for today. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Ryan, I want to ask you about the event yesterday in just a couple of minutes, because I love it when just normal everyday people ask the questions rather than TV hosts, because they're so different. And then when they ask follow-ups, it's just a very different experience altogether. But before we do that, you wrote a chapter in your book about Nancy Pelosi called Pelosi's Party. And you write that, you know, even before she came to Congress, she was a powerhouse fundraiser. And I learned a lot of new things just about, you know, what it was like when she ran and just her political kind of upbringing. What really stood out for you when you did your research on Nancy Pelosi?
Well, a lot of people are confused about Pelosi. She's kind of a riddle to them because, you know, they look at someone like Steny Hoyer or Chuck Schumer, like, okay, you know, we get these figures, you know, we get these characters, we understand them. But then you look at someone like Pelosi, you're like, she sometimes seems like a real progressive champion. You know, she also represents San Francisco, which she's fond of pointing out if she needs to. But at the same time, she's so good at kneecapping the left and sometimes even mocking them in public. You know, she said a glass of water could win AOC's district. She called it the green dream. In my book, she says that, we're going to have to do something about the environment this term because the teenagers want us to, after the Sunrise Movement occupied her office. And so you wonder, how can, you know, where does this person come from? And so you have to kind of, take her whole portrait together to get a sense of her. But she is, you know, out of this tradition of a kind of fighting liberal. That was against the kind of tweed jacket, kind of above the fray liberal where she felt like you have to, you know, use all of the tools of politics as effectively as you can, or you're going to lose. And she was, like you said, an absolute champion, a fundraiser in the Bay Area, and she rose through the party ranks in the 1970s and 80s by being so good at that. And as her mentor Phil Burton, a congressman from the region, was also rising through the House of Representatives, just as the party's reliance on big money, you know, was starting to take hold. Phil Burton was kind of a pioneer in California of gerrymandering. And other techniques to just use the power that you have to screw over the other party and to advantage your own party, while at the same time his list of progressive accomplishments is legion. You can find them all on Wikipedia, but Social Security disability would just be one among a ton of others that he really deserves credit for. So Pelosi watched as he fought hard. He raised a ton of money, and he made progressive change as a result of that. And so, you can see how as kind of she's coming into her political own, she says, okay, that's the route to power. I mean, and that's the route to actually doing good. But you can also see how, as you do that over the decades, that kind of the big money becomes becomes an end in itself, and you start using then your parliamentary skills that you've honed over the years against the left rather than against anybody else, because it's the left that is kind of challenging your authority in a real way. You know, when in 2018 she was questioned about whether or not she'd be able to rally enough support to become speaker again if Democrats won in November, she said yes, and when asked why, she didn't give one of those looping answers that she's famous for. She gave a very clear one. She said, because I'm the best fundraiser. And so she understands that kind of her power, she draws her power from her ability to excel at the thing that the current Democratic Party's strategy needs the most. You know, if all of a sudden it's a people-powered party where your ability to marshal millions of small donors and millions of people who are going to volunteer to be precinct captains or to go door-to-door, to phone bank, to hold house parties, to participate in a variety of different ways as well, then that requires a different skill set that somebody else has or somebody's else have. And so, so you wind up in a place where preserving your position in the party structure becomes almost more important than advancing what some people would think is the kind of goal of a political party, which is, you know, to act as kind of a vessel for the hopes and the dreams of the people it represents, rather than a party, you know, just sustaining itself for itself.
And as you know, Ryan, San Francisco has a lot of money. I mean, the Democrats come to the Bay Area to have big donor fundraisers on a pretty regular basis. They go to Silicon Valley. Is it true that Nancy Pelosi raises about $100 million a year? Do you know?
That's a fair estimate. Mm-hmm. It's an absolute fortune. And it was fun to go back and read her early read about her early political history and talk to people who knew her and the political climate at the time. You know, she she won in a special election to replace her mentor's late wife. He died, then his wife took his spot, and then she died, and she had the endorsement of her on her deathbed. She had the backing of kind of the San Francisco establishment, and her leading opponent was the vice chairman of the Democratic Socialists of America. So again, we see so many parallels, and there was this huge, you know, insurgent grassroots energy behind her opponent, Harvey Britt, who incidentally was a city councilman who passed the city's first civil union law, which Mayor Dianne Feinstein vetoed. She said it was too soon; people weren't ready for it. And the election came down to the wire. You know, just a few thousand votes separated her from the DSA vice chair. And, you know, so then she went on to win the general. She, you know, if it's a top two like it is today, she probably ends up losing in the general election. But so when she says, you know, I represent the Bay Area, I understand the left, what she means is, you know, she's been battling them and that she's beaten them. And to be sure, a knowledge of something comes from tangling with it, but it's a different kind of understanding than people might think she means.
Ryan Grimm is D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept, and he's out with a new book, We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up, we will play the last two live shows we did as part of our series here, Histories of Exclusion and Resistance. Tomorrow, we will talk about Japanese American activists who organized a trip to a former internment camp and an immigration detention center in Texas to protest the separation and indefinite detention of families. And then on Thursday, we will air a conversation about building solidarity across communities to protect civil rights and civil liberties. And you can find the entire series of Here at kalw.org. Click on Your Call, and then you will see the Here tab. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Ryan Grimm, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts today just about the state of the Democratic Party, specifically the corporate wing versus the progressive wing? What are you hoping for from the candidates? I really wish we didn't have to talk about this so early out, but this is how the cycle is in this country now. The first debate is next week, and the election is not until November 2019. But California does matter for the first time. We're going to be voting in March of next year. Today, we're joined by Ryan Grimm. He's author of We've Got People. He's D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. The difficulty, as I see it, is deciding whether the Democrats, when they begin to go to the country club to infiltrate their group, eventually really feel pretty comfortable at the banquet table. I would cite two examples that are of concern to me. One was when Kamala Harris recently came out for Medicare for All, she was questioned, are you really going to eliminate the insurance companies? And she said yes. And then she backtracked. And she, oh, no, there'll be a place for the insurance companies. To me, that is pandering to the money group. And when Joseph Biden opened his campaign with a big banquet, a fundraiser sponsored by Comcast, I don't know what there is to say after that.
Well, yeah, thank you, William. Ryan, you've got a lot of other examples in your book about this. How would you address William's concern and question?
Yeah, no, it's true that there are instances that make me feel almost irrelevant as an analyst or as a reporter because they're so plain. They don't need anybody to unpack them for them. And I think that Joe Biden starting his campaign with a Comcast fundraiser certainly is one of them. He really does represent big money's best shot at this. This is the horse that they're riding into this final battle, between kind of small donors and the rainbow coalition left that Jackson was pushing in the 80s, and the big moneyed interests. And in some ways, you have to see the big money class at a serious disadvantage just by the horse that they're riding. Imagine you're the donor class. You've lost a lot of influence in the Trump wing of the Republican Party. You still maintain a sizable amount of clout over in the Democratic Party, but Joe Biden is the candidate that you're sending out to the field of battle for this this existential conflict. This is a guy who left the 1988 presidential campaign in disgrace, with about 1% in the polls, and somehow managed to get caught up in a plagiarism scandal. 2008, he ran again and barely earns a mention in the history books. And actually, when I wrote my chapter on the 1988 campaign, I had to kind of go back and think, should I mention something about Biden here? But he was so irrelevant that it wasn't that he was barely worth mentioning, but he is the one that is kind of carrying that mantle for them, and he's an awfully weak candidate to be doing it.
The New York Times also had a good piece recently by Shane Goldmacher called "Wall Street Donors Are Swooning for Mayor Pete. They Like Biden and Harris Too." And Shane Goldmacher reports that New York's top donors are already beginning to pick favorites. They like Biden, Kamala Harris, and Pete Buttigieg. And according to this piece, these Wall Street donors are having events from morning until night. And they've got a list of things that are happening. The executive vice chair of Blackstone hosted Buttigieg at his home. A short-selling hedge fund manager, James Chanos, is holding an event for Biden on Monday. Mark Lasry with a hedge fund is gathering checks for Kamala Harris. And I've read this in the past. Politico had some stories about how Wall Street says anybody but Bernie and anybody but Elizabeth Warren, because those two are really talking about inequality, taxes, and Wall Street.
That's right. And the fact that they have Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg on their list shows that they haven't really, consolidated around a single candidate that they think is going to be able to beat the left in this race. Now, to their advantage, perhaps, the left hasn't consolidated around a single candidate either. Like you said, Sanders has strong support, and so does Elizabeth Warren at this point. But you're right; those are the two that Wall Street fears the most. Each kind of in its own way, but both view as kind of almost existential threat to them, which I think is overblown because of the balance of power that we have in our system. But they certainly are playing for keeps.
Well, thank you for the call, William. Let's go next to Sarah in Santa Cruz. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So my head sort of exploded when you were talking about the Democrats wanting to impeach the second George W. Bush. Are you still there?
Yes, go ahead. We can hear you.
Sorry. So my head kind of exploded because it now makes sense to me why Trump thinks he can get away with all that he is doing, because essentially Nancy Pelosi let George Bush, the second one, get away with similar things. And I'm wondering if you think she's making the same mistake again, if this is like deja vu. Or if she is smart not to try and impeach him, Trump. Does that question make sense?
Sure. The best case that you could make for the way that she's handling it is that the media tend to treat questions that are open as ones that they kind of cover relentlessly. And if you think about the Mueller report, what will it say? What will it find collusion? Will he recommend indictment? And so it gets this relentless coverage, and then the second that it becomes public, without even reading it, the press moves on, because now the mystery is gone. Well, here's a PDF of the document. Now what's next? And then what's next for them was, well, will he be impeached? And so you could make an argument that, and I don't think that this is her rationale, but you could make an argument that if Democrats open impeachment proceedings, then the media would say, oh, well, okay, well, we know how this ends. He's convicted in the House and he's acquitted in the Senate, so let's move on and stop talking about impeachment. Instead, they're talking about using the word impeachment and Donald Trump in the same sentence 24/7 now. I don't think that's actually the intended result, but it is the actual result. But you see instead from Democratic leaders in the House this huge frustration that the press wants to talk about Trump's impeachment while they want to talk about their legislative agenda, which would be interesting if they had an interesting legislative agenda. If they were pushing a Green New Deal, if they were pushing Medicare for All or free college or investigating ICE or something that kind of resonated with the public. But what they're doing instead are things that pull through the roof, like lowering drug prices. I think just today they're working on legislation that will lower drug prices. And if you ask anybody on the street if they think that lower drug prices are a good thing, they're, of course, they're going to say yes. Of course they are. But they also, I don't think, believe that anything that House Democrats are going to do on Tuesday is going to lead them to have lower drug prices, at any point in the future, particularly with Mitch McConnell in the Senate and Donald Trump in the White House. So, you know, their alternative strategy to focus on a legislative agenda would require them to have a serious and popular legislative agenda. So in the absence of that, they're almost lucky that the media wants to talk about impeachment.
Well, Sarah, thank you for the call. You know, Ryan, since you brought up the media.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I do think her point is an important one, that there's a principle at stake here around the rule of law, and that by letting Bush off the hook, both through, you know, by not launching impeachment proceedings in 2007 and then with Obama not, you know, prosecuting lawbreakers from that administration, the law becomes, you know, much more difficult to enforce, and executive power just expands and expands to what we have now.
Right. Right. Well, thank you, Sarah. And we'll do a show about impeachment because obviously they don't have the votes in the Senate. But if the Democrats don't do anything, it just sets a very bad precedent. So we're going to definitely do a show about this. Ryan, I wanted to ask you, since you're in Washington, D.C., and, you know, you rub shoulders with other D.C. journalists and the pundits on television, I just wonder if you can give us any insight into the thinking, because I have to say, what drives me crazy is when I hear the media, and they say this all the time, that we are so divided, things are so divisive, Washington is broken. You know, these are very simplistic statements. And when you look at where people stand on certain issues, they're really not that divided on a lot of things. I mean, you know, 70% of the population does not want Roe v. Wade overturned. And yet it's called the most divisive issue of our time. And so I just wonder, where does that come from? Because no one can argue that the Republicans and the Democrats play by very, very different rules. I mean, you had Obama say, we just need to find consensus. I mean, they were beating him up, and yet he kept saying, we need to find consensus. That would be great, but look who you're dealing with. So can you give us some insight into that and what you think about it?
I mean, part of it is that there's a real fear among, you know, people here in Washington, journalists here in Washington, of being called biased in a liberal direction. You know, a lot of journalists do come from kind of metropolitan areas and have, you know, elite college educations, and as you would expect, you know, have personally, you know, somewhat progressive politics, you know, pro-choice, you know, for, you know, in supportive of LGBT rights, you know, those sorts of things, and so they are aware of that, and as a result of that, they're nervous that their reporting is going to be infused with some sort of bias, or more importantly, they'll be accused of having some sort of bias, and so they elevate the other side, like as you said, you know, 70% plus 80% more, you know, support Roe v. Wade, but if you are a journalist and you yourself support it, you might want to say that, well, you know, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, and make it appear as if it's a much more kind of even and balanced situation. At the same time, there was a tendency among liberals to kind of resent people to their left, to see them as, to see them as kind of shaming them in a way. To see them as self-righteous, you know, who are you to say that I'm not as left as you are? You know, I want a just and peaceful world just like you do, and so it creates this tension with people that you're closer to that you don't have with the right, because there's no kind of personal connection there. You know, the people on the right are just people to be reported on and to be studied and to be, you know, looked at as creatures of interest. Whereas, because there's so much overlap between the left and liberals, it ends up creating more hostility between the two. And so, you know, it's funny to watch it play out in newsrooms. If a conservative reader or a conservative pundit or newspaper, you know, complains about the tenor of a publication's coverage, they grapple with that in a very serious way. They may not do anything publicly, but they'll meet about it. They'll discuss it. They'll take very seriously the charges, and oftentimes it works. If it doesn't work in that case, that their coverage then is shaded in a different direction, you know, in the future. If a left outlet or a left reader criticizes a mainstream publication's reporting, the mainstream publication shouts back at them in a really aggressive way, which really demonstrates the kind of dynamic that I'm talking about. And so, there are a lot of different things going on, but that's essentially what it boils down to.
So journalists are still in 2019 afraid of being accused of being liberal.
They are. Yeah, it's there is a mythology that I think does have some value. That journalists are above the fray. I get it. That's not the kind of journalism that I practice, but I get that in some cases you very much do want a media that is trusted by all sides. I tend to think if you report a lot of things accurately, even if it's clear that you have a certain perspective on it, you'll be trusted on all sides. We at The Intercept have actually a pretty solid readership among Republicans and among the right. They know that what you're reading is going to be accurate, and it's often going to be kind of on the leading edge. So if you want to get ahead of where things are going, read it there. But I get the point that they're making. But sure, yes, believe it or not, today it's still an obsession of many journalists.
Today we're speaking with Ryan Grimm. He's D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept and author of the new book, We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. Ryan, I just realized we're almost at the end of the show. I wish we had more time. I want to ask you about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez because it has just been fascinating to watch her. I mean, I still wonder, because things move so fast, do you think that people realize just what she and the movement pulled off? I mean, winning her Democratic primary, unknown to the majority of the country, Joe Crowley did not see this coming, and his supporters. I mean, he had backers from Silicon Valley to Lockheed Martin. This was a stunning defeat of Joe Crowley. Since we're short on time, can you just summarize just how big of a deal this was?
I mean, one way to think about it is that we're not even at the one-year mark of that primary. That'll be next week. Next Wednesday, June 26th, would be the one-year anniversary. And I've noticed that because there's another critical primary coming in Queens for prosecutor on June 25th, which is Tuesday. And in fact, Ocasio-Cortez has backed the insurgent candidate in that race. But so in less than a year, the big Green New Deal has gone from virtually non-existent to something that's at the centerpiece of the 2020 campaign. I had watched so many insurgent candidates come close and lose that you're never sure. I certainly wasn't sure. People have said, "Oh, you really predicted it." I didn't. I was not at all sure that she was going to win. I knew she had a better shot than people thought, but she has a political ability that has enabled her to continue to rise. Since then, I think Joe Crowley stayed on the ballot, and I think was hoping that she would kind of flame out at some point and become such an embarrassment to the district that he'd be asked to come back in the general election and kind of run and continue to represent the seat. And she rose after the primary and just kept going, and it really has kind of reshaped the conversation. At the same time, the House of Representatives is a morass. As Pelosi has pointed out, there are she said, "Oh, there are three or four of these people," and while there are a lot more people in the House that sympathize with Ocasio-Cortez, it's not terribly unfair of Pelosi to say that there are very few members who are willing to take as bold a stand as Ocasio-Cortez is. So, her rise both shows how far the movement has come in the last less than a year, but also how very far it still has to go, and with how little time we may have left.
And to that point, Ryan, she sits on very powerful committees, including the House Oversight Committee, and it has been really amazing to watch Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 29-year-old novice to politics, question some of the top executives in this country, from the banks to drug makers to weapons companies, and she is taking them on in ways that I have not seen many politicians do in the past. And, you know, given that, do you think that she's really making a difference just in the way that politics is practiced in the House?
Yes. And what she's showing is that if you're not spending 4 and 5 hours a day on the phone, you know, calling rich people, asking them for campaign contributions, that you could you can be out studying the issues and prepping for your next hearing. You know, she barely ever misses any moments of a hearing, which is questionable, because that's a considerable use of valuable time. But it results in the kind of moments that you're talking about. Elizabeth Warren sort of pioneered that over in the Senate, but you know, she has expanded it, and now you see lots of other members of Congress trying the same thing. And I think that's a permanent change in politics.
Hmm. Well, you can search for some of those clips, because it is really incredible to see her question Bank of America CEO, for example, or ask a drug company representative why an AIDS drug is incredibly inexpensive in Australia and costs thousands of dollars here in the United States. Ryan Grimm is D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept, a contributor for The Young Turks, and author of We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. Thanks for joining us, Ryan, and we'd love to have you back to talk more as these debates continue.
Anytime.
All right, thank you. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I hope you can join us tomorrow. We will begin two shows looking at Japanese internment. It's the last of our two shows as part of our series here, Histories of Exclusion and Resistance. And tomorrow we will speak with Japanese American activists who were involved in a trip to a former internment camp and an immigration detention center in Texas to protest the separation and detention of families. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.